Octa Non Verba is a show that's raw and real, featuring hard-hitting interviews with people that live by the ethos of actions, not words. Marcus Aurelius Anderson is a TEDx speaker, best-selling author, veteran, and leadership and mindset coach. With this show, you get to join Marcus as he goes inside the minds and experiences of the world's most successful warriors, leaders, entrepreneurs, and experts. With each episode, you're going to get the philosophies, concepts, tactics, and strategies these leaders use to turn adversity into victory. Live an extraordinary life based on actions, not words. Now, here's your host, Marcus Aurelius Anderson.
Octa Non Verba is a Latin phrase that means actions, not words. If you want to know what somebody truly believes, don't listen to their words. Instead, observe their actions. I'm Marcus Aurelius Anderson, and my guest today truly embodies that phrase. Rabbi Yonason Goldson, a.k.a. the Ethics Ninja and the Hitchhiking Rabbi, works with leaders to create a culture of ethics that earns trust, sparks initiative, and limits liability. He is a very highly in-demand keynote speaker, business advisor, award-winning podcast host, and author of 7 books. His column, The Ethical Lexicon, appears weekly in Fast Company magazine. Now, I was introduced to this incredible gentleman by my great friend, our mutual friend, J.C. Glick. And we were just discussing before what an amazing gentleman he is, truly a warrior scholar, which we need more of in today's culture. And thank you so much for taking the time to be here today.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Marcus. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm excited about it. I'm about to finish my second book and release it. But in my first book, I put this aspect at the very end. You've written 7 books. So oftentimes we want to put everything into one book and then we realize I don't have this bandwidth or I won't be able to maintain the presence of the reader if I do that. But there was one that I couldn't help putting in right before the editor after the deadline, which was this notion of it's up to us as leaders, as educators, as fathers, as husbands, as sons, to understand that we have to be able to absorb truth irrespective of source. And sometimes that's the most difficult lesson that we have to learn, or sometimes we miss the lesson and then we have to trip over it again in the future in order to bring it back into play. Am I close, do you think?
Yeah, and it's really a fascinating kind of duality there that we learn best from sources that we trust and respect. You know, this is why it's so important for parents. You know, the fifth commandment is to honor your parents. That implies that parents have to make themselves worthy of being honored, which, having raised 4 kids, is not a simple matter to do consistently. It's there's no harder job in the world. Teachers as well. Students will not learn from teachers that they don't respect. But at the same time, as we get older, because we should always be students, we should always be learning, maturity should guide us to recognize truth when we hear it, when we're exposed to it. And that's something you and I were just speaking about, that it's so much absent in our society. There's no separation between the source and the idea. And if it's from somebody we don't like, we don't agree with, it isn't our cup of tea, we naturally invalidate the idea. And we're doing ourselves a tremendous service and we're doing society a tremendous disservice.
Yeah, there's these confirmation and cognitive biases that unless we're aware of them, we will continually be ambushed and tripped up by that. And in your TEDx talk, you make some tremendous points. One of them I love, which is this idea that oftentimes we have to have the courage to look brutally at our own beliefs and say, why do I believe this? And then you bring that secondary point, which is, did I choose the belief or did the belief choose me? So oftentimes there is this generational attachment to this belief. So if a person disagrees with me or a person comes at me sideways about something that I believe so wholeheartedly into my soul, it doesn't only slap me in the face, but in my mind, right, the emotion that is evoked means you don't respect me, my parents, my grandparents, anybody in my generation, anybody within my heritage that believes this, that has given this to me. So that's why it is so far reaching, even though, as we understand, at the end of the day, these are simply words, and the only meaning that they have is what I allow them to have. Can you talk a little bit about that?
That's an interesting idea. I can get theological maybe, but before I do, one of my, in my TED talk, I quote one of our modern sages, relatively contemporary sages, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik. He says that all fanaticism and extremism comes from insecurity, that a person who's secure cannot be an extremist. And I think that's very much what you're describing, that when we get ideological, in the sense that we invest in ideas that we haven't thought through, we haven't reasoned our way to them, then we're naturally defensive. We know we can't defend our position, and that makes us insecure. And it's much easier to attack the source than it is to actually try to articulate what we believe or go back and revisit what we believe. When I gave the TED talk, I wasn't familiar with the quote I learned later from Carl Jung. He says, different words, people don't have ideas. Ideas have people. And it's a really powerful idea to think about. And what's the worst thing that happens if we reconsider? We discover we're wrong? Wouldn't I rather be wrong so I can start being right than persist in being wrong? But our egos are involved, our identities are involved, our associations are involved. I mean, you look at the political landscape. By moderate, I don't mean that you just plant your flag in the middle. I mean, you moderate your thinking, you moderate your speech, you moderate your thought, and you engage, you look at both sides. I mean, I have trouble listening to the news anymore because I can't find anything that I really trust or rely on. I used to spend part of my time listening to Fox News and part of my time listening to NPR. And my liberal friends would say, how can you listen to Fox? And my conservative friends would say, how can you listen to NPR? Because if I listen to both of them, maybe I'll have a chance of finding some kind of balance.
And it's so difficult because as human beings, we're using this software and hardware that we've been given centuries ago, and now given this technology that if we allow it, will give us, like as you and I are speaking right now, something is going on that everybody is going to have either vitriol, venom, or victory around. And they cannot wait to get out there and spew it to whomever will listen or whomever will disagree. And you and I were discussing how the amount of time that we have on this earth is always limited. The amount of capacity and focus and presence we can bring to anything is limited. So I am not going to spend my time trying to convince this person that there is no way that I could possibly convince them. I'm not going to spend that time when I could be giving it to someone else, when I could frankly be getting more out of going for a walk or taking a nap than trying to engage this person in this emotive language or this concrete bound dogma that they are just pretty much, they're holding the hand that holds them down because that's what gives them that courage so that they don't have to look at the potential of cognitive dissonance, which is for them something they cannot take.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that because I just said this over the weekend in a presentation. The sages teach, know how to answer a heretic. They don't say engage the heretic. And you know, heretic can mean anything, you know, spiritual, religious, philosophical, political. And what they're really telling us is that you have to know whether or not it's worth your time to engage someone. However, I need to know why I don't agree with this person. Otherwise, I'm just another ideologue. I'm just coming from a place of dogma. And if I'm insecure, again, if I'm insecure in my own beliefs, then this person is challenging me, is going to put me off balance. It's going to make me doubt myself, doubt my convictions. Now, maybe I should go back and revisit them. Or maybe I just need to be more secure in understanding why I believe that. But then beyond that, sometimes we do have to engage. Because often when people confront us, they don't want to hear our answer. They just want to find out if we have an answer. Because if we're not articulate in expressing our views, then they can call us out on that. And more important, there may be people standing on the sidelines who are listening And this is why sometimes I will engage people in social media, even though I figure there's very little point in doing so. Because there are people who are watching the thread, there are people listening to the conversation, and they want to hear if there's an articulate response. And if I don't give it to them, maybe nobody will. And then they'll be sucked in to another side because they've only heard one side, even if that side really is not intellectually sound.
And it's so true that there are absolutely hills that we need to die on when it comes to our beliefs, but there are 90% of them that we don't need to. So again, being able to pick that battle, understanding what's at stake, understanding what's going to serve, again, the community, the people around us, as long as we're not doing it from, like you said, this place of ego or literally the threat to our ego and the fear that that may instill, I believe that that's the best way to look at it. And again, from religion to philosophies, many times they discuss this notion of anger, being able to detach from it, seeing what's the below the surface of that. Oftentimes it's fear. Oftentimes it's insecurity. Oftentimes it's just that question. And to have somebody that we see adversarially looking at us from that capacity, asking the very question that we ourselves are afraid to answer or afraid to even look at, it's like our worst nightmare come true.
Yeah, I was waiting for you to use the word adversary. In your TED talk, you talk about adversity. I never quite made that connection between adversity and adversary. Linguistically and philosophically. But what I thought of watching your talk is that in Hebrew, we have the term, in English, it's Satan, and in Hebrew, it's Satan. But the literal translation is adversary. Mm. We don't see some guy in a red suit with pitchfork. We see a divine emissary who is dispatched to put obstacles in our paths. And when you look at the military, you look at the special forces running obstacles. So, well, why don't we remove the obstacles and then they can run the course faster? Because, of course, that's not the point. The point isn't how fast you can run. The point is, what do you do when something comes in front of you that's trying to stop you from running? How do you negotiate your way over, around, or through so you can carry on? And, you know, there's so many examples of this. You go to the gym. You start working out with 5-pound weights. After a while, there's no challenge there. You go up to 10 and 20 and 30 and 100, however you can go. You get on the treadmill. It starts to get easy. You turn up the resistance because that's going to make you stronger. And that's why you're in the gym in the first place. So life is a workout. Our job is to grow, to make ourselves stronger spiritually, morally, in terms of our character. And so from the theological point of view, God puts you could even think of him as, if you would, as a kind of physical...
like a trainer or a coach of some kind.
Trainer, yeah. Tough word. What does a coach do? A coach makes things tough on you because that's how you get better. You've got all these movies about these tyrannical coaches that everybody thought they were crazy, and then the team won the championship and they're big heroes. Well, in hindsight, yeah, it all makes sense. While you're going through it, that guy's out of his mind. So we're up against obstacles, and they never go away. They just change over time. Because what was a challenge last year or the year before or 10 years ago shouldn't be a challenge now. And what's impossible now will be possible down the line somewhere if we keep pushing ourselves. And the only way we're going to push ourselves is if we've got a coach or a trainer or an adversary that's forcing us to reach deeper and develop ourselves and get stronger and persevere. That's how we achieve greatness.
I couldn't agree more. The physical manifestation of adversity is an adversary. And adversity is the thing that forces us to up our game. It never allows us to do just enough to get by. It knows our potential, even when if we're unwilling to see that, which is why it punches us in the mouth if we're not listening or paying attention, because it's trying to get our attention. That's why there's that pain. And I love that analogy that you have of this resistance training, because the actual stimulus is the adversity that we face, that friction. but the growth happens after if we're able to reflect. And oftentimes, if we've had a workout that pushes us, we wake up the next day, how do we feel? Not great. Sometimes sore for many days. So having that residual emotional bruising, that emotional adaptation that shows us I'm needing to adapt. I'm starting to adapt. And whether it be physiologically, philosophically, religiously, ethically, this is part of that process. And I absolutely agree. So many times for us, we hope that it's easier. I can't wait till this is easier. I want to fast forward through this hardship right now to get to the easy part. But if we live our life like that, you'll notice that there will be hardly anything in our life that's worth reflecting on. Once we understand and make peace with the idea that adversity is omnipresent, it will never go away. It will never become easier for us. And even when we level up, there's a greater adversity waiting for us. Everybody wants to be stronger, but they fail to see the idea that you have to be just as willing and excited to accept the adversity requisite to become stronger, to become more intelligent, to be more of an empty vessel when you're listening to somebody, to have that pragmatic empathy and apply it in real time, even if it's towards a person who is saying something that you could not agree with less. That's where that humility is, and that's where we can grow. And oftentimes, just being able to listen to that without allowing it to influence us either positively or negatively, that's sometimes a lesson that we have to learn from adversity.
Yeah, and it's so helpful when you can find examples in the physical world that reflect these deeper, what we see as spiritual truths. The Hebrew word for a spiritual level is a madrega, which literally translates as a step or a stair. And if you think about going up a staircase, the moment you get to the top of one step, you have simultaneously arrived at the bottom of the next step. And I find it just such a powerful image of each success leads me to a new beginning. And that's really what makes life worthwhile, because you know, you get to the end of a good book, you get to the end of a good movie, and there is this immediate letdown. You're so immersed in the story. You've connected with the characters, and now it's over, and there's nowhere to go. You know, J.K. Rowling only wrote 7 Harry Potter books. How many millions and millions of people got invested in those characters? And now what? Where do I go from here? My rabbi said to me once, if there's no friction, nothing moves.
It's up to us to turn that friction into traction.
Yeah, exactly.
We have to be adaptive enough to be able to see that additional route, because if we don't, it will rub us raw for the rest of our life.
Yeah, intention. There's I'm still trying to find it. I heard someone make reference to it, and I haven't found it yet, but there's apparently a Japanese poet who speaks of a violin string lying on the table. That string is free and cannot produce a sound. It's only when it's put in place and there's tension, that's when it produces beautiful music. And what we were talking about earlier, this unwillingness to engage people who think differently from us, the polarization of political parties and ideologies and social movements. No, I actually saw online somebody trying to engage protesters, and they turned around, put their hands over their ears, and started chanting, "Walk away, walk away." Speakers come, shout them down. "We don't want to hear what you have to say." "You don't know what I'm going to say." There's supposed to be tension in our lives. We're supposed to be talking to people who don't think just like us, which incidentally, they say is very helpful for slowing down the advance of dementia, Alzheimer's, and intellectual decay. I mean, yeah, go learn Italian, great. You know, take up new hobbies, take a different way to work. It's all good. But talk to people who don't think like you to get your mind working, because you've got to explain yourself and you have to try to show them that you're making the effort to understand what they're saying. And if we could do more of that, so many of our problems would just disappear.
I couldn't agree more. You've written so many books. Even for me, writing whether it be in adrenaline capacity, writing something as like an article or books, it forces us. It's very much almost that Socratic method where I have to put down this statement and now I have to examine it. Is this a passing emotion? Is this influenced by positive, negative? Is this true? Hemingway says, just write the truest thing that you can, that one sentence, and then go from there. Because in his experience, all the other superfluous things was just window dress that was eventually going to be cut away anyway. So starting from that kind of premise is key, but it makes us really be aware of what's going on. And the beauty is we can look back on those. You have 7 books, so each book is sort of a snapshot of who you were in your intellectual and philosophical and religious development in that moment. But that picture changes. It's going to be similar. We're still going to be able to recognize you, but maybe a few things are different. And then before you know it, you've sort of evolved into this person that has this capacity to adapt, to be fluid within that environment, finding truth. And then as we're speaking to people, we can usually smell the truth on them. We just have to kind of see what's the direction they're trying to get to from this current point. And I think that's lost on people many times.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. You use the phrase smell the truth. That really goes to a deep spiritual idea that in Hebrew, the words for spirituality and fragrance have the same grammatical root.
Wow.
Because fragrance is the least tangible of our senses. It's the hardest to quantify. And yet, because of the way we're designed, right, the olfactory nerve goes straight up into, is it the limbic system? My biology is not that good.
It's near the rear of the brain, which is for, like you said, memory, right? Yeah, so hardwired into us to remember that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, people can, you can, I mean, that's why there's a $1 billion perfume industry. It's operating below the conscious level. And it taps into something very, very deep in us. I was giving one of my first model lessons, interviewing for a teaching job. You know, I was calling on students, getting them involved. And afterwards, the board members were observing the lesson. And one of them asked me, with this student, you jumped right in and helped him. And with that student, you let him struggle. Why was that? I said, I can't really articulate to you why I took one approach. I sensed that this student needed help, and I sensed that that student would get there on his own. And I still remember what this fellow said to me. He said, I like that. I said, I don't trust people who think they can articulate everything.
It's very true, right? And oftentimes that instinct is there. Like you said, that kind of, that smell instinctually, what are we doing? That's what kept us alive. If I smell something that smells bad, I probably want to avoid it. But something that really attracts me to it, of course, that may be a food source or something else that creates these positive cascade of emotions. And you're a rabbi, but I love this idea that you started as an atheist, transitioned into this agnostic, and then eventually arrived at the point that you're in here. Could you tell us about that conversation that you had that got you from being just this concrete-bound atheist, and then what else led you on this path to where you are currently?
Yeah, I tell the story of my TED Talk, and I've told it many times, about a high school classmate who I'm reasonably sure does not remember me at all, and yet he had a profound impact on my life. We were sitting, I can still visualize the conversation. We were seniors, it was morning, we're in the senior lounge before class started. And for some, I guess we're just sitting next to each other because we weren't particularly close friends. And for some reason, I declared I was an atheist. I don't tell it this way in the TED Talk, but he said to me, "That's stupid." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "It makes no more sense not to believe in God than it does to believe in God. You can't prove either one. Why do you want to believe in something you can't prove?" And the way I like to tell it is I did something completely out of character. I agreed that he was right. And so I changed my label. We don't quite use the word agnostic properly, but I declined the state. I'm non-independent party. I didn't take a stand on God. But that put me in a frame of mind where when I did end up in religious seminary after hitchhiking cross-country and backpacking across Europe and traveling around the world and wandered in simply because I wanted a place to stay and but had no expectation of dramatically changing my way of looking at the world. And I came into the presence of a teacher, again, somebody that it was impossible not to respect, not to admire, and really impossible to refute. You know, his arguments were so compelling. And, you know, it wasn't just me. It was there were a couple of us, a couple of others that we, you know, we would huddle after every class and try to pick apart what he was telling us. And we all ended up religious. But there was really that, and I don't know where I got it. It was something that I guess are hardwired or just we absorb them from various influence. But I got to the point where I really couldn't come up with a good reason not to accept what he was telling me. I mean, I exhausted every argument I had, any you know, challenges, and just in good conscience. Do I just walk away from this? Because I don't like the way it makes me feel? Because it's not the way I was planning living my life? Because it's really cool to be a seeker of truth, but what, you found truth? What do you think you are? How arrogant.
Absolutely. In the martial arts, we see a similar path where if I'm a black belt or I'm an instructor, the burden is for me to teach this art. It's not a burden, it's my responsibility. And you're always going to have that person that walks in off the street that comes from this complete area of freedom, but it's also this area of ignorance. And they come in and they're curious, they're inquisitive. Maybe they've been aware of this. Maybe they've seen a movie. Maybe they've heard a quote, something philosophical, whatever leads them into the room. And once they're there, you start teaching. And invariably, the thing that you're teaching is not going to be their expectation of what a martial art or what fighting or whatever their interpretation is. And so eventually you get to the point where you're sparring or you're rolling with them in jiu-jitsu or what have you. And that's where the rubber meets the road. That's where they start to, because just like you were saying, verbally sparring with your instructor, that rabbi that was telling you all these things and saying, go ahead, what is this? Allow me to counterpoint. That's very much where it's at. And then as they go through and they understand, and again, what's often driving that person, whether it be a martial artist or from a religious standpoint, this aggression or this question or this lack of understanding of what's really going on. And then once you put them in that position enough times to where they're checkmated or they're tapping out or they catch the punch in the body or the kick in the leg or you ring their bell a couple of times, now they start to realize, oh, this is the definition of insanity, to keep ramming my head against the wall of this logical fallacy that I thought was true for so long. And as you said, very much, once you find that truth, either that person sort of is converted to, I don't want to say religion of the martial art per se, but there's very much a very, very many similarities to religion and martial arts. Because if you were in this martial art and you go teach, learn from this other person, sometimes that's a splinter group of that other one and they don't appreciate that. But truly, the martial arts don't really care about our opinion. The truth is the truth irrespective of what our idea, what it should be. And if we're willing to do that, oftentimes we'll get that convert. Or as you say, that person comes to class long enough to realize what they don't know. And then they leave and they may go to another school to try to figure something out. But we, much like when you were teaching your students, the ones where this person, you could just sense that they needed more experience with you there. That's where that case-by-case basis is important. And that's why we have to meet them where they are, as opposed to trying to talk over their head. Because to many people, that's not only is it jargonistic, but it seems disrespectful. But we also have to teach just above that current understanding to give them the ability to reach for that, to start to get to that place. And I think that that's a very underutilized and overlooked aspect of it. because we have to challenge them to an extent, but not so much that it's either overwhelming or so much that they're going to completely just disregard it and then walk away from it in the process.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite stories in teaching is I used the Socratic method because I didn't want to be up there pontificating.
Right.
I wanted to show my students they could often think their way to the answer, or at least think of the questions that will point them in the right direction. And I still remember this one young lady, very bright, straight A student, sitting in the front row, burst out in exasperation, "Why can't you just tell us the answer?" And critical thinking is not something that you learn by being spoon-fed. But, you know, I really like your analogy of the martial arts. I never quite thought of it that way. The idea of sparring against an instructor. And the job of the instructor is not to flatten the student, because that's, what does that accomplish, right? And it's also not to go easy. It's to be just one level above where the student is, because that motivates the student. Right? That's the adversary again. Exactly the same idea, to do it verbally, to do it intellectually, to do it physically. What we're trying to do as teachers is to develop students who don't need us anymore. The job of teachers and parents is to make ourselves obsolete. And, you know, I had a professor in college for Shakespeare. He loved it when we argued with him, which was rare, extremely rare. But when I got to seminary, I was immediately in my element, because the whole style of teaching and learning was challenging, asking questions. You know, that's what it is. So you go into a library and you turn the pages too loudly and people stare at you. You walk into a Jewish house of study and you think you've just walked into a European soccer match. I mean, these people are shouting and pounding the tables and jumping up and walking around, and it looks like absolute pandemonium. But what's really going on is this passionate debate over how to understand the ancient teachings so that we can have clarity on how to apply those principles into our lives. And it's by design, the style of learning, because so much more comes out when we are struggling, grappling, debating, arguing with each other. As long as the objective is to get to the truth.
And back to your comment earlier in the conversation about the violin string, Viktor Frankl says, you know, a man does not seek a attentionless state. It has to be this good and evil, this light and dark, these opposite ends of the spectrum. And that tension is where we are. That's who we are. That's what we're experiencing in that moment. And the way we conduct ourselves in the face of that adversity is an indication of how we will conduct ourselves in every other arena that we enter. So if I am not able to apply that in real time, physically, intellectually, spiritually, mentally, then I'm very much ill-prepared for any adversity that I face in my life.
Yeah, I mean, when you put it into, you know, all the different areas of family, you know, it's... I come from the old-fashioned school of thinking where there's a husband and a wife, father and a mother. And, you know, there's a reason why biologically we're designed that way. It's not just physical. It's psychological. I mean, male and female thinking are radically different. Sometimes we wonder after we've gotten married, you know, what was I thinking? It's hard work. I mean, talk about tension. It's always there. And yet that's what makes great partnerships. When we take our differences and we take our different strengths and ability and we complement one another, mm-hmm. You know, that's the famous yin and yang symbol. It's the light and the dark, the strong, the passive and the active, the mature and the youthful, the flexible and the firm, the male and the female. This is what it's all about, and it fits in very much with Jewish philosophy in that sense. but then take it into business. You know what they say, if you have two partners doing the same thing, one of them's irrelevant. You want different people doing different jobs because that's how a team works. You don't want 11 Tom Brady's on one team. It's not going to win any, not going to win anything. And to discount others because, well, I'm doing something important. They're not. But if I couldn't be doing it without them, what basis do I have for discounting their efforts? You know, when I talk to people about business and I explain why ethics is so essential to a healthy business culture, that is the foundation of loyalty and trust and commitment and passion and engagement. And the line that I hear frequently is, what you're saying is so obvious. Why don't people get it? And, you know, it's a better question. The answer is they don't want to. We're so caught up in the short-term goals, the short-term profits, the short-term benchmarks, that we forget where we're trying to be. And then the culture then supports that. You know, you have to keep the stockholders happy. You have to keep the investors happy. I mean, you hear these reports in the news. Such and such a stock fell because their predicted earnings were less than they... their earnings were less than the predicted earnings. Wait a minute, they made money.
Right.
They're moving in the right direction.
Yeah.
It's so backwards.
It is. I love that idea too. This, when I was speaking to Dr. Mark Goulston, we were discussing him before he recently passed away. And when I addressed him, when just like with you and I at the beginning, I kind of want to talk and understand where this person is in this moment, let alone what their body of work has been. And I addressed him as doctor, and I said I had tremendous respect for him, and his work has influenced me. His book, you know, Just Listen, changed the way I coach, the way I lead, the way I do everything. And that skill set alone, that singular skill set that you learned to master as a hitchhiker, because you were an empty vessel with zero expectations and you were just there. I always say pragmatic empathy. Empathy and empty are spelled similarly for a reason. I empty my vessel so that I can be filled up with this person in this presence without thinking of what I should be saying next or judging or helping or fixing. And before we hit record, he said, is this how the whole conversation is going to be? Because I don't want this. Just very succinct, very direct. And again, he knew that his time on this earth was very limited. He said, I want to have a conversation that's deep, that's transparent, that's raw and real. And if we can have that, let's do it. And after the conversation, after we had been able to just go through and put everything on the table and just be very honest, afterward, he said, this is off air, he says, I think I owe you an apology. I said, you don't need to apologize to me, Mark. And he said, no, he said that the thing that he has found is that a lot of people that address ethics or come across very hyper respectful, he said, there's this distrust that he has established from other people in the past that have done that. Either it's a lot of arrogance, or they tried to kind of sideswipe you or got you with something, ambush you with a question, or there's a lot of anxiety on their part and they don't have the capacity to just be who they are. He said, but you're one of the like 5% of people that actually, that is who you are. That is what you believe. And I said, yes. So back to your idea of ethics, it's so important in a business. And again, it's simple, not easy. And I think that that's why it's so important to have that as this cornerstone in every environment, culturally especially, because we see many people that will have core values on a wall or on a website. But when the rubber meets the road and the push comes to shove, oftentimes, as you say, the board or the shareholders are the ones that are kind of pushing the buttons and pulling the levers. And now this person who is bought into this feels like they've been duped. They feel like it's been bait and switch. They feel like they've been lied to, frankly, and they've built their existence and they're literally putting their hours of life into this thing. And that's not what the case is. Can you address that? I mean, I'm sure you've seen similar things. You're smiling. I know that you have.
Yeah, well, you just reminded me of a story I heard years ago in an interview. It was a woman who had grown up in a small rural community. And she went away to college. And she very quickly discovered that people were using a word that she had never heard before. Evolution. And not only did everybody know this word, But everybody believed in this principle. And it clearly contradicted the religious value she'd been raised with. And she used the same word you just used. She felt she was duped. She felt that her community had lied to her, deceived her. She wanted nothing to do with them. And she abandoned her Christian faith. And I thought it was just so sad because it's so unnecessary, you know, to be afraid of an idea. You remember, I mentioned Harry Potter before. Remember the evil Lord Voldemort, right? He who must not be named. And Professor Dumbledore says, use the name. Right? When you're afraid of a name, it just breeds fear of the thing itself. If you're afraid to engage people's ideas, you're doing yourself a disservice. But look at here. You raise a young woman in a community according to a set of values, and you don't prepare her to engage the rest of the world. You're setting her up for abandonment, abandoning the values. And so when I taught, and it was an advantage I had coming from a non-religious background, I had gone through this process myself. And so I always encourage my students to ask questions. And if they didn't ask the questions, I'd ask them for them. And it's so gratifying to see young people develop the ability to think for themselves, to recognize that an idea has merit, not because they were told it does, but because they've grappled with it themselves. And I mean, what's really exciting is when a student asks me a question that I haven't thought of before. And the sages say, I learned much from my students, more from my colleagues, and most from my teachers. Because when we're being taught, we're mostly passive. When we're talking to our peers, it's back and forth. But when we're teaching, we have to be able to communicate in a way that the students will receive. That means we have to put ourselves in their place. We have to anticipate their questions. And we have to create a style that's going to allow them to really become active participants themselves.
Yes, I've said this many times. My listeners are probably sick of it, but there's this martial art analogy that says one teaches to learn. And then if we really embody that, it becomes this idea that one teaches to learn. So as I'm teaching, I'm continuing to bring that through because that student, again, that they're a blank slate. If I'm saying something that doesn't make sense, they're going to come back with these very obvious questions. But sometimes the way they pose it is different. Sometimes the order in which they pose it is not expected. And sometimes if they're saying something that in my mind is blatantly false, I'm the source. So actually I'm doing it wrong. I'm not articulating it in a way that they can understand, or I'm not giving it to them in a way that's consistent. And then now that makes me better at those ideas. In the military, they call it feeder-receiver mentality. We have to have that ability to be fluid and say, okay, in this moment, am I trying to apply this? Am I trying to learn this? Am I trying to teach this? The reality is we're doing all three simultaneously. We just have to be aware of where we are in that orientation in real time.
Yeah, and really, I have a quote from one of my college professors. He said, I never understood why people complain about being disillusioned. I would like to be relieved of my illusions.
Yes, it's one less burden I have to carry, right?
And, you know, it goes back to the ego that we're talking about. You know, when I got to seminary, I was 24 years old. I graduated, you know, honors in my field, traveled the world. And I, you know, I had life all figured out. And then all of a sudden, I come into a situation where I know nothing. Literally, nothing. And the little I do know is probably wrong. It has a devastating effect on my ego. That, you know, do I really want to put myself in a situation where I'm starting over from scratch? I'm not even at square one. You know, it was agonizing reappraisal. And I was determined to justify rejecting it. But I was fortunate that the relatively few teachers I had who really impressed upon me commitment to intellectual integrity had the influence that they did, because it made it impossible for me to walk away from them. And I don't know exactly where that comes from. Certainly not universal.
And there's some people that may be listening now that had this notion of a religious belief or a believing in God or in source or the universe. And I know there's some semantics with that, but to them, having an organized religion may have, maybe they've had negative experiences in the past. Maybe it just wasn't a good fit for them. Are they still religious? I mean, is that technically an agnostic? This is a question that you're very uniquely qualified
to. I have tremendous respect for agnostics. True agnostics, because we use the term agnostic as kind of like, I don't have an opinion. But a real agnostic is somebody who believes that God is unknowable. Well, what entitles you to believe that God is unknowable until you have made every effort to know God? Like being an atheist. Why are you entitled to be an atheist until you have made every effort to discover whether there might be a God? What are the reasons for believing in God? You know, the labels are easy. Are we really living up to them? You know, the first commandment, which is very interesting. You ask people the Ten Commandments, most people can't name more than two or three. The first commandment is, I am the Lord your God. Well, that's not a commandment, that's a statement. Well, in Hebrew, they're actually called the Ten Statements, so. But nevertheless, they're understood to be commandments. So what is that first commandment? Well, some of the commentaries say it means to believe in God. But that's problematic, because who's commanding me? If I believe in God, I don't need God to command me to believe in him. And if I don't believe in him, then nobody's there to command me. So the way we understand it is it's expressed as a statement of fact. Because it's telling us, you have to deal with reality. The force of gravity is not going to stop operating because you don't like it. The world is either flat or round. Either we put a man on the moon or it was done in a movie
studio.
You can believe whatever you want, but reality is what it is. And if I don't believe in that brick wall and I walk into it, the brick wall does not care that I don't believe in it. It's a statement of reality. And we have five senses. We have intellect. We have a community of people that we can check in, our perceptions. If I think I see leprechauns floating around you, I can ask you, are there leprechauns there? And you say, no, maybe you need to go get checked out. Mm-hmm. They say creativity doesn't happen in a vacuum. Wisdom doesn't happen in a vacuum. There have to be conversations like these, which is why what we're doing here is so valuable and so wonderful. There is empirical evidence in this world that will point you in the direction of a creator. And so, well, I know it. No, there's not. It's science. Science will answer all my questions. Really? Science can explain how the Big Bang happened. Science can explain spontaneous generation. Science can explain all the gaps and problems with evolutionary theory. Science can explain dark energy and dark matter. Science can explain all the contradictions of quantum mechanics. I mean, every time science comes to a new understanding, it opens up all kinds of doors of confusion, which does not mean we abandon science. It means that we recognize the limitations. And just like a jury is not supposed to determine 100% guilt or innocence, but is supposed to eliminate reasonable doubt. And it's the same thing in approaching life. Any decisions we make, we look at probabilities. I stand on the street corner, I'm going to cross the street. Maybe these cars are all illusions. Maybe I'm just imagining them. Maybe. I can't prove they're not. But what are the consequences if I assume they are? And I walk against the signal. We live our lives according to probabilities. And that's really what that first commandment is saying. It's saying, don't settle for easy answers. Don't believe what your superficial perception tells you, because there's so much more to that. I'm sitting at a desk. It feels really solid. Science tells me it's made up of particles spinning around at the speed of light. Why should I believe that? Well, apparently a lot of really smart people have convinced themselves it's true, and it has very little impact on my life. I can invest myself in atomic theory, and it's not going to change a single thing I do. But if I invest myself in belief in a higher power, that's going to call on me just for some serious reflection. If there's a creator, why am I created? What am I here for? How am I supposed to find out? How should I live my life that's consistent? What are the consequences of not living my life in a way that's consistent with the intent of that creator? These questions are not going to go away just because I don't want to deal with them. So what's a logical, rational way? Well, there are all kinds of avenues. But the willingness to expose ourselves to ways of thinking and ideas that may make us uncomfortable, that may challenge us to reevaluate and reconsider our axioms and our basic principles. Listen, if I'm on solid ground in what I believe, then I've got nothing to be afraid of, because the evidence will support me. And if I'm not, well, don't I want to find that out?
And these are the questions that mean something. When I was injured and paralyzed for 4 months, I was forced to grapple with all these ideas. And I think that especially today, there are so many artificial distractions with electronic social media, AI, whatever it is. We can keep ourselves artificially pacified literally for the entire existence that we have on this mortal coil if we so choose. But the actual path that you're discussing, this idea of understanding that the easy answer is often not the answer that I want. And my experience, adversity doesn't guard anything that is not worth having. It has to have some sort of pushback so that we earn that knowledge. As human beings, we don't respect what we don't earn in some capacity. And back to even Jung, when he talks about this idea of beware of unearned wisdom, we have to have this ability to question everything, even our own beliefs that are rock solid for us in this moment. And to strawman some of the things you're saying, because I think that it's healthy, there are some people that are out there that have a belief, but they still can't fit evolution into that. How do you answer that for them to give them this understanding of where they exist or coexist or divergence or convergence?
Yeah, evolution is really a non-issue for us. Go ahead and believe in evolution, because it might be true. But if it is, then it was guided by the divine. You want to talk about age of the universe? I don't know if we want to get into that right now, but there are ways of approaching all these questions. They all have rational, logical explanations that can fit into our theology. So you don't have to choose. Anybody who says, I have to choose between science and religion, hasn't studied one or the other or both adequately. Because there's something intuitive about that. And there's also something cultural about it. Right? If you're a creationist, you can't be scientific. If you're an evolutionist, you can't be religious. Well, yeah, do some homework. You can find a lot of religious scientists. And you can find plenty of scientists who may or may not be religious, but are honest about the limitations of science. There's a wonderful TED talk by a guy named Harry Schiff, I think his name is. And I remember watching it. Don't even know how I found it. But he works with the CERN, the particle collider in in Europe. At least you did when you gave the TED talk. And he said, well, he's talking about the scientific investigations and the theories. And he says, and we're only a few years away. And I think to myself, oh boy, here we go again.
Here it comes.
And he said, we're only a few years away from concluding that we are never going to be able to understand the universe. And I thought, bravo. For a scientist to be able to acknowledge the limitations of science in such a public forum. Another interview I heard on NPR, the guy's talking about dark energy. What's dark energy? It's this force that seems to be causing the universe to accelerate, which is contrary to laws of physics. And he said, you know, calling it dark energy is kind of disingenuous, because when you put a name on something, you're implying you know what you're talking about, and we have no clue. You go on the NASA website, they'll tell you the same thing. There are so many things we don't understand. And in a way, that is logical from a theological point of view, because if the Creator is infinite, then how could we possibly presume as finite beings to understand the infinite? It's what's called supralogical. It's logical that there's a limit to where our logic can get us. Now, that's not carte blanche. I can't just say, well, it doesn't fit with my view. I'm going to disregard it. That's not intellectually honest either. But again, it's that tension between these two ways of looking at the universe. And, you know, even limited to science, the tension between Newtonian physics and quantum physics.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Newtonian physics is great. We rely on it all the time until it stops working.
Exactly.
For most of us, it makes no difference at all, because it doesn't affect our lives one bit. But if you really want to understand the nature of the universe, you're stuck with these two models that don't work together. And then when you start resorting to answers like, well, aliens seeded the universe with biological material, okay, that will answer some of your questions. Doesn't answer where the aliens came from.
So it gives you a lot of other questions on top of that answer.
Right. And more than that, it's where's your foundation for saying that? The multi-universe. I mean, they call it a theory. It's not a theory. It's not even a hypothesis. It's a notion. And by definition, it's unprovable. So, oh, well, we don't have to prove it now because it's unprovable. You know, there's so much more faith involved in believing in the power of pure science, because the evidence just isn't there.
That's it. Nassim Taleb made a comment in either Black Swan or Anti-Fragile. He says, theorists believe that theory and reality are the same. Realists understand that they are not. And we are living in this place of reality. So it's so important for us to be able to, in real time, understand that.
Yeah, there's a line by Dennis Prager. I'm not a huge fan, but he's very articulate in many things. He said he was accused by a group he's speaking to a group of atheists. And he said, please raise your hand if you have ever doubted your belief that God does not exist. He said, not one hand went up. And he said, that's the difference between you and me. Because for religious people, we question our beliefs all the time. And that is a source of strength.
And dare I say, many atheists conduct themselves as a radical. It's just that's the belief that they're trying to champion. Very much this extremist idea. It's, again, what do? They throw the baby out with the bathwater. If you're a Christian, you believe in a man in the sky, then you're an idiot. Well, that's very dismissive, and there's zero capacity for me to accept for why do you think that? And again, if they're just going to go through and make statements and whatever their leanings are, again, I can't have a conversation with that person. But I'd like to ask you this, because I think this helps us understand, too, the ability to apply what we're talking about. When was the last time you had an opinion or a belief of yours that used to be absolute? When was the last time you've had that overturned from evidence, logic, your own introspection, meditation, prayer, et cetera?
That's an interesting question. You know, I mentioned earlier that when I was teaching, I would delight when students would ask me questions I hadn't thought of. But over the course of my teaching career, which was 23 years, it happened less and less because more and more questions got asked. There were less of the questions, at least on a high school level, that were there to challenge me. So I don't know if I could say any particular belief has recently been overturned. I can say that I'm constantly modifying my way of looking at various issues. I'm always looking for new ways to articulate ideas. And part of it is the culture. You know, you have to speak, or, you know, I want to speak the language of the culture, because that's much of what I do. And the conversation we're having here is not really my primary focus when I'm not speaking to religious audiences. I'm trying to take these principles and apply them to society and the business world. But I want to be able to speak in the language that people speak. And so, you know, as somebody who was raised with classical English grammar, it's very hard for me to say they when I mean he.
Yes.
And I'm not talking about people's chosen pronouns. I'm just talking about standard language.
Yeah.
He was the pronoun that was used for a group of people of indeterminate gender. Well, society has decided that that's not proper. And so now we use they in place of the singular, where we would have once used he. Now, it's uncomfortable for me, because I think that when we start redefining the meaning of words, we cause confusion. But as you said earlier, that's not necessarily the hill I want to die on. Yeah, the Oxford comma might be, but... You know, you have to adapt. You have to be able to speak people's language. And we were talking either in the show or before the show about self-censoring. There's some topics I just try to avoid because I know they're so incendiary that I'm going to lose people when I might be able to talk to them about other things where, you know, they'll start to hear some of what I'm saying. I used to write a column for the local metropolitan newspaper, the Post-Dispatch, and my editor, like most metropolitan newspapers, it was a fairly liberal editorial slant. But the editors I worked with were professionals, and they wanted different viewpoints, not just their own, which is also harder to find these days. And I still remember my editor saying to me, you know, you're the only moderate I know it doesn't sound flaky or wishy-washy, which I took as a high compliment. But, you know, again, we were talking about this, that being a moderate doesn't mean just plant my flag in the middle somewhere because it's arbitrarily the middle. It means to moderate my thinking and my speaking and my conduct, you know, to recognize that in a pluralistic society, there are lots of different ways of looking at things. We're not going to get, I mean, you know, what's going on in politics these days? You know, the political parties are insane, frankly. They've been hijacked by extremists. It makes compromise impossible. Compromise is a dirty word.
Yes.
It makes gridlock inevitable. It makes the whole society dysfunctional. Okay, I don't like you. I don't like your ideas. We got to make this work. One, because it's our job that we've been elected to do. And two, because we want to live in a healthy society. We want to benefit people and not just try to beat each other into submission.
That's the key. I think also when we look at this, in my TEDx, I quote Bruce Lee when he's, you know, when we start looking at the similarities instead of the differences,
yeah. We
have many, many more things that we have in common. So instead of battling semantics and splitting hairs and becoming idiosyncratic about things, why don't we agree on those 95% of the things that we do agree on and allow that space for the other things?
I think that when people use the word diversity, there's a connotation attached to it that is not moderate. It's either right or left. And I feel that, again, that's disingenuous, because I'm not saying that we just allow somebody into a position that's not qualified, that doesn't understand, that can't do the job. At the same time, there have been many times when I've worked with organizations and companies that it was that person who wasn't quite cut from the exact same mold of everybody else that gave that perspective that nobody else could find, that gave that idea of being a little bit more detached because they weren't completely fluent in the lexicon, that allowed them to ask the question that opened everything up. And to answer the question that I posed to you, well, she'll be 22 this month. I have a 21-year-old stepdaughter, but I call her my my cosmic daughter, because it's like we've, you know, been together for so long now. And I've learned from her, you know, I came into her life when she was 15. So we were fast friends, and immediately, you know, roughhousing and having a great time, teaching her martial arts, teaching her all these things. But then she's also 15 and discovering boys and going through all these changes and learning to drive and this high school and all these things. And I learned from her that rigid discipline across the board does not work. If anything, sometimes it, B.F. Skinner, right? He talks about this notion that sometimes people enjoy the idea of, it becomes a cat and mouse game of avoiding punishment. That's the thrill. And then when they get caught, they just sort of allow themselves to be reprimanded. But they're already, I don't want to say scheming, but they're already anticipating the next time they do this, how will they be able to circumvent that and get away with it? And I'm not saying that to cast anything nefarious towards her, but it was just, it's what I saw. It's like, if she and her mother, who's my wife, are disagreeing and I'm the third party, and they're both right, correct? They're both very, very right. And they're impassionate about that thing that they're right about, but they're both also wrong, and they don't want to look at where they're wrong. And that dovetail of where they're wrong is where the commonality is. And for me, a long time, I had to be able to say, can I say something? Am I entitled to say something? Is this my place? And then eventually, again, because of the love and that relationship and that trust and that respect, I eventually got to that place where I was able to sort of point those things out. Now, was I a referee and I said, you go to that corner, you go to that corner? It was more of talking after everything is settled, having that conversation with both of them together, independent, without me knowing that I'm having a conversation, to give them that space to express, what are you upset about? What are they not seeing? What are you saying that's not being heard? What are they saying that you're not hearing? And what are you afraid to say that you feel nobody will hear? Giving that ability to facilitate and show them those things. And again, that's where that tension is, very much what we're talking about. This is where the world in which we live. Being able to navigate that in a way without being just like this either dictatorial, authoritative person, or being this person that is so wishy-washy, it's like, you do whatever you want. There, again, the hill that we die on. Where are these extremes? Where can I balance this dichotomy in real time and be present to come up with the solution? This is a solution for this moment. Is it the solution that's going to last forever? Probably not. But it's understanding where we are in real time right now, and then being able to walk it in to a place where there is more of this understanding. And dare I say, now that she's older and she's gone out and lived some life, she's gone to school and she's had to pay rent, and there are certain expectations that you have to do, whether you feel like it or not. Now, we've taught her everything that we possibly could from a moral standpoint and ethical standpoint. Now, adversity and life will teach her everything else that she's not quite sure about. And now she comes to me with more of these questions and more of these understandings, which is the best compliment I could ever get.
Sure. I mean, you've become the trusted advisor as opposed to the authority figure.
Right, or the enemy, or the guy that's on her mom's side. I'm her dad, and I'm on, it's like, no.
Right. You know, that the power of the outsider is, that's exactly the point. I'm exactly on the same page with my customer diversity. You know, I wrote a recent piece called Diversity Ethics and Inclusion. Because it's an understanding, you know, this whole idea that equality of outcome is just unrealistic. It doesn't work, it can't work, it won't work. And trying to make it work is just going to frustrate all our efforts for anything positive. you know, in my TED talk, I talk about the great schools of Jewish learning 2,000 years ago, Academy of Hillel and the Academy of Shammai. And it's recorded that when they debated in the study hall, they argued with such passion, it was as if they fought with swords and spears. But it was never personal. And when they left the study hall, they were friends. They got along. What I didn't say in that TED talk is that we have a large body of work of their collected teachings and debates. The minority opinion is always mentioned, even though it was the authors of the majority opinion who wrote it down and assembled it. But the minority is not only mentioned, it's mentioned first. Because it's only when you understand the other side of the issue that you can truly understand your own. And they didn't change each other's minds much at all. But the process of debate, discussion, has informed Jewish law for 2,000 years. Those discussions are the basis of the practical laws that observant Jews follow today. And it's all based on that intellectual integrity, that willingness to listen and understand and reconsider, and the commitment to ultimately both sides seeking the truth.
That's all we can do. We believe in principles and not people. People are malleable and fallible. Principles are consistent. And that's something that we can constantly kind of hang our hat on.
Yeah, and I think that goes back to a point that you made earlier, that you know, it's easy for us to get disappointed or disillusioned in our institutions. And we have to be willing to look at the values first, the people second, and then even among the people. Not everybody will live up to every expectations, but some people are. And I think it was Simon Wiesenthal who, he was in the camps. And afterwards, he met with another survivor, one of the great rabbis in North America, his name was Eliezer Silver. And Rabbi Silver saw that Simon Wiesenthal was no longer religious and was anti-religious, even though he'd been religious at the beginning, which is not understandable, and many people had that. So he asked him, and he said, "I'll tell you what really did it to me. There was a guy in the camp who had smuggled in a prayer book, and he allowed other Jews to use it, but he charged them. He made them give him some of their bread to use his prayer book." And I saw that as it is such a corruption, extorting people so that they can pray to their God. I said, I can't believe in a system that would produce something like that. And Rabbi Silver said, "You're right, but you're making a mistake. Why don't you focus on all the people who were willing to give up their bread so that they could connect with their Creator?" So for every aberration that you see, you might see at least as many and maybe more people who are devout and sincere and consistent. And human nature inclines us to focus on the negative. It's easy to make the effort to see the positive, to see the good, and to not judge the system by those who are not living up to the system. That's not the system's fault. That's our humanity. We struggle. And maybe some of these people would be much worse if they didn't have the system giving them a baseline.
Absolutely. Rabbi, I could talk to you for hours, and I'm sure we'll have more conversations from here. Where can our listeners go to purchase your book, to learn more about you? You're a keynote speaker. You're speaking very often. Where can they go to book and learn more about those things?
My website is ethicsninja.com.
Ethicsninja. I love that.
Some say it sounds like a contradiction, but no. You know, who are the ninja? They lived in the gray areas.
They were very fluid in those areas.
They tried to use their enemy's strengths against them. I think it's a useful image. So ethicsninja.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn, where I'm very active, Jonas Goldson. And please reach out, be in touch.
Absolutely.
Always looking for new conversations.
Thank you for your wisdom.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Mine as well.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Okta Nonverba. If this message resonates with you, please share it out with others on social media. Hit that subscribe button and leave a review for the show anywhere you listen to podcasts. To learn more, please go to MarcusAureliusAnderson.com and join his Okta Nonverba Inner Circle to get exclusive content, news, and information. Until next time, remember, talk is cheap. Live your life based on actions, not words.